You're listening to Psych Talk, bringing you conversations on everything related to psychology. Psych Talk podcasts like this one are based on the live show aired on Carborough Community Radio. Listen in live on Tuesdays at 2 p.m. on WCOMFM.org. On this podcast, Serious Games, or video games teaching real-life skills that could, for example, help us solve complex business and social problems. This show on Serious Games comes in two parts. First, we'll talk with Phaedra Boinadiris, who creates Serious Games at IBM. Then we'll have our trivia challenge with a local contestant. Let me start by telling you a bit about Phaedra. Phaedra Boinadiris is an entrepreneur with an MBA from UNC Chapel Hill. She currently manages IBM's Serious Games strategy for the public sector, which includes government, military, healthcare, and education. The International Game Developers Association recognized her as one of the top 100 women in the gaming industry for her work founding WomenGamers.com. Her games include Innovate, a series of games teaching business process management, and City One, a city simulation targeting real-world logistical, environmental, and business problems. She has spoken at numerous conferences worldwide, including the DARPA Innovation Summit, GDC, E3, Digital Hollywood, European Serious Game Summit, Triangle Game Conference, and SiegeCon. She joined us so we could explore the social, educational dimensions of serious games. Here we go. So Phaedra, thank you for joining us on Psych Talk. It's great to have you here.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
And you're calling all the way from Greece, so it's it's quite a globalized conversation here.
Indeed, indeed.
Let's start just with an initial gut reaction people might have when they hear serious games, video games, and IBM in the same sentence. They might wonder, well, IBM, they don't have their foot in video games, do they? So could you tell us a little bit about why you're at the helm of Serious Game Strategy at IBM and maybe the story, a little bit of how that happened?
It's kind of a strange story. Most people who work in serious games typically come from a background in instructional design or e-learning. And I came about it through a much more circuitous route. My sister and I, about 10 years ago, decided we wanted to start a company called WomenGamers.com. And in essence, this was before Farmville, before the Nintendo Wii, back in the days when people didn't believe that women would in any case be interested in video games. But we knew we played, we knew our friends played. We noticed that most gaming magazines, most gaming websites were targeting young men, so we knew there was an untapped market. Mm-hmm. So we started this company, and we started the first scholarship for women to pursue degrees in game design and development, mainly because we had so many letters from people saying, you know, if you've got issues about the games out on the market, why aren't more women designing them themselves? So we really wanted to establish a community that fostered women who wanted to get into games, whether it's designing or developing. And so
that's great.
We started this company, and after doing this for about 10 years, where we did consulting to game studios and publishers who wanted to target women, mm-hmm. I decided to go and get my MBA at UNC's Kenan Flagler Business School. And okay. While I was there, I stumbled upon serious games through a case competition. I ended up presenting an idea for a game to IBM. Mm-hmm. And as luck had it, one of the vice presidents for IBM was one of the sponsoring judges. And she pulled mm-hmm. me aside and said, hey, this sounds like a great idea. Can you go ahead and make this for us? And that's wow. That's how it all happened. Who would have thunk?
Yeah, you sort of stumbled into it.
Yeah, exactly, exactly.
And so beforehand, IBM didn't have any involvement with serious games, right?
No, they did. They had two games that had come out. One was a game called Power Up, which was a game running on, I believe it was the Torque gaming engine, okay. which was made available for free, teaching kids, K through 12, some ideas or information about energy conservation. There was another game out about how is it, it was a Java programming game. Where based on how well you wrote your Java code, you got to pimp your robot. So it was very interesting. Yeah, they've come out with a couple of games prior to my joining IBM.
Okay, so they're gradually building up their repertoire.
Correct.
But now you're at the helm, and I want to switch tracks a little bit from this story of how you got to IBM and how IBM's a growing presence in serious games. I want to talk a little bit more about the games themselves. So I've given a little explanation, a one-liner, what serious games are, but what are some examples of what you would consider serious games? And you feel free to talk about what you've worked on.
Well, I see great potential for serious games. And if you look at the kinds of serious games that are currently out on the market, typically they fall into a few categories. Okay. The kinds of games that I'm very interested in are the games that help explain complex systems or that enable the facilitation of people to collaborate to solve complex systems problems. I think there's a huge future in that. I mean, if you think about the kind of world that we're living in today, I mean, we're surrounded by so much data. By such complexity, and if we can figure out a way to motivate people to collaborate in an environment that makes sense, where you can really stress test ideas, there's huge potential in that. So that's kind of where I'm interested in taking it.
Right. Well, that makes a lot of sense. I mean, you'd think from staring at textbooks, you're never going to understand something as complex as an economy or whatever, even fluid dynamics. There are all kinds of things that seems like maybe you need to get your hands dirty to really understand how something's working.
No, that's exactly right. Because if you can use a contextual environment to wrap your arms around what the system is, and then take that a step further and stress test ideas associated with that system, and then take that a step further and say, okay, how do I collaborate with others to improve upon this system? I mean, there's so much you can do with that. And then you take methodologies from entertainment titles themselves. How is it that you continue to motivate people, you know, whether it's rewards-based systems or reputation? You know, all of these tricks of the trade really make this medium even more compelling.
Right. Well, I don't want to get too stuck up on terminology, but as we're talking about complex systems and rewarding people within these systems to learn in a new way, one question that comes to mind is about different things that can happen in virtual environments that might not be games. For example, you can think of a flight simulator. And there could be a clear difference from what you've worked on. And then there's something in between, maybe like The Sims, that's SimCity, it's more of a game, and virtual worlds like Second Life. So there's this whole zoo of things you can do in a virtual world, depending on what game elements you do or don't put in or how accurate you make something. How do you think of all these different ways of teaching people complex things through a computer or online?
I think that it's wonderful that we've got so many mediums to play around with, that each one has their own special value. Virtual world, I think we've seen some great strides in it. I fully expect we'll see much more to come. They have their place in terms of offering a new channel for people to be able to convene and coalesce and meet virtually. I think that simulations, obviously the military has been investing in simulations forever, that we're going to continue to see yet more complex simulations. What I like about serious games is that what we've seen to date from the military and from healthcare mm-hmm. has been just the tip of the iceberg. What the opportunity is now is if you can create serious games that have some serious applications on the back end, some serious commercial grade muscle, where you can, for example, take a take a serious game that has real data and motivational capabilities and rewards-based systems and reputation and ranking and actually offer a contextual environment for people to collaborate. This is something that's unprecedented. So, you know, you take what you can from these wide variety of different mediums and really be able to stretch it to do something very different.
Wow. Well, it sounds like we have a very interesting future ahead of us. We'll have to stay tuned and how these combinations play out.
Agreed.
I want to talk about one specific example. I know it's just a proposal, but it's something that's very cool to anyone with any sort of psychology background. A game that's supposed to help people recognize cognitive biases. So this sounds very challenging to teach anyone about their own biases or about biases in others, thinking more objectively. So could you tell us how it might work?
Yeah, I can't give you too much detail, but what I can tell you in general mm-hmm. is that if you can create a game that can teach people how to recognize cognitive bias in themselves, mm-hmm. so how is it that they might be able to approach decision making mm-hmm. in a new way? The repercussions of something like this could be huge, you know, whether it's in the financial sector, whether it's in the political sector, I mean, whatever the case might be, being able to discern what effects biases have, how is it to recognize it, and then how to mitigate it. It could be hugely significant.
Right. Well, if this idea works out, psychologists would be amazed because they've tried just preaching to people about biases. They tried in experiments, like making people read all kinds of things about biases, and then immediately afterward, testing them to see if they recognize their own biases. And people just are really resistant. Maybe a game in that sort of interactive environment, the motivational structure is what it takes to finally break through. But I hope one day I'll pick up the New York Times and read about the success of this.
Yeah, I hope so too.
Well, I know you can't tell me any more there. You might have to kill me or something. So. I'll take a little bit of a detour here and moving away from specific examples and back to, again, the process that's involved in making a game. And we've already talked a little bit about when something's a serious game or simulation, how these might breed. But clearly, there's all kinds of legwork that's involved in making a good game. And especially when you're putting real-world aspects and learning into a game, there needs to be all sorts of collaboration happening between universities, companies, governments, and other knowledge-generating institutions. So you must have had some experience with, or maybe some good and some bad, with this sort of collaboration. I'm curious what works about it, what might need to be improved, and where you see it going.
Well, I typically, what I found works well is a five-step approach. And the first step is always determine what is your case for ROI. What is your return on the investment? How are you going to show to your investors that this game was a success? You know, is it the fact that people are going to learn better? Is it the fact that you're going to sell more stuff? What is it in particular that you want out of this? Mm-hmm. You start off with that. And then step two is document what it is precisely that you want to teach, as precise as you possibly can. Mm-hmm. And then the third step is actually the most difficult in my estimation. And that is match the puzzles or the experience with what it is you're trying to teach. I can't relay to you how many times I've had people say, you know, I want a game like World of Warcraft to teach database administration. And it's not quite a good match, but you know, you really have to think hard about what is the right experience to match what you want to teach. Okay. Once you've got that, you can determine your game genre, and then you can determine what's your platform going to be. So where is your audience? How many times are you going to have to update the game? You know, what are the other components of it to really blow out the tech and the platform?
Okay. And how do you see different actors working together to make these steps happen? I'm thinking, for example, the case for ROI, that sounds like something that someone working in the corporate world is going to be best positioned to have insight into. And then step two, we'll flip right into academia, maybe documenting what exactly needs to be taught. A university is going to love to talk about that and not about step one, right?
Yeah, well, it's vitally important that everybody learns how to do step one, whether it's corporate, whether it's academia, because someone's footing the bill for this.
Right.
You know, same thing with military. It all comes from taxpayer money and from Congress. So there's got to be someone to say, okay, here's how we're going to prove that this medium, this methodology works. And you always have to start there, because you might need to build in certain hooks to prove that as you're building the game, you know, whether it's some sort of reporting or you might have to integrate it with another system. That right. information is really key to start with.
Right. And of course, serious games aren't, you can't just look at sales and say, oh, people like the game, people are enjoying it. Maybe that's what would happen with conventional games, but there's always some pretext of teaching people or of
right. Right.
changing
people's
minds. Did the
game work? Right. Did
right.
the game work to do what it's supposed to do?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's tough.
Yep. Well, it's not easy.
Yeah, I could take your word for it there. I wouldn't really know. But then even tougher maybe is that puzzles part. You were starting to talk about how tricky that can be and how clients or collaborators can start off with not quite understanding how messy that process is.
It can be, because, you know, they'll come to the table with something in their minds. For example, they'll say, you know, I mentioned the World of Warcraft and database administration, but they might think, oh, you know what? Database administration really isn't fun. You've got to throw in things like Pac-Man and Tetris into the game itself so that you have little breaks of fun to break it up or whatever.
Interesting.
But it doesn't work that way. I mean, people see through that. It's kind of like chocolate broccoli. I mean, you can't
right.
You can't just throw in, you know, Tetris into something and say, okay, now it's fun and now it works. You've got to
right.
think about what is fun about what you're trying to teach. Mm. What is that special way of teaching the subject that makes it engaging? You see what I'm saying? You know,
yeah, that's hard.
And it is hard. It is. It's not always an easy thing to do. But if you can crack that nut, then your investment is going to be much more valuable.
Right. You need something more like chocolate peanuts than chocolate broccoli.
Right.
Okay. So we've got all these steps that all which can have their own pitfalls. And then one aspect that I know you've had experience with that you've been successful with is assembling the right team of people or having the right Rolodex and knowing how to coordinate people. What would you say about the motivations and skills necessary of a team that's going to pull off a good serious game today or in the future?
In my estimation, it's people who really understand games. So it can't be folks strictly from the e-learning world. It's got to be people who understand modern games out in the market today, because in the entertainment world, they've already tackled so much of what can be used for serious games to motivate people and create collaborative environments.
Right.
So that's really key. But also on the flip side, those who can take serious content and be able to do that step three, which is help match the puzzles and the experience to it. So that's why, I mean, it's hard to find people who can do both of those. It's really, really
right.
hard. So it's not everybody who can pull off the creation of these kinds of games.
Right. Well, hopefully people will start to learn to combine those skills better, and people who have those skills will, I don't know, get more visibility and get cultivated.
There's no doubt in my mind, especially considering, you know, the average age of the gamer is now 37. I think the Entertainment Software Association just came out with their new report. So,
wow, yeah,
I mean,
very against stereotype.
Yeah, you look at the age of the gamer. I mean, there's no doubt in my mind that this is going to be a medium that's just going to continue to expand.
Mm-hmm. Well, you've said before that serious games can't teach everything, even though regardless of all the expansion that Serious Games have, all the potential, all the great talent that could really boost it, there's some things that aren't quite as suited for Serious Games. So I was curious what those things might be.
Oh, that's an excellent question.
And maybe we don't know. Maybe we just know that we don't know. I don't know.
Well, yeah, and I could give some examples and then somebody's going to come and prove me wrong. And you'll get tons of emails saying, I've seen a fantastic game to teach XYZ.
Right.
I don't know.
Maybe one example of something that's especially tough right now.
I would say something like balancing the budget.
Ooh.
I think that would be a really tough one. Or maybe, how is it that politically you can solve major world crises issues? I think there's an opportunity for games to maybe cut out some of the, make some chinks in that armor. How is it that you can tackle components of that? But to solve such a huge mass problem, I think is, whew, I wouldn't even know how to begin.
Right.
But again, someone's going to come and prove me wrong, which would be great.
Okay, well, I hope it happens soon because, it's funny, the examples you gave with the debt ceiling arguments happening in Congress, balancing the budget and world crises are both very important problems.
So. I would agree. A big balancing the budget. But that being said, maybe there is an opportunity. If you could create a serious game that at least touched upon the first layer of the budget crisis issue and allowed people to create what-if scenarios and test out theories. Maybe that's completely doable, but
yeah,
I'll add that to my list.
Okay, good. I'll be waiting for that.
As will we all.
This is Jose Lopez, and you're listening to Psych Talk. Right now, we're having an interview with Phaedra Boinodiris, who manages IBM's Serious Games Strategy for the Public Sector. We're taking a little break because I want to relate something that happened yesterday, very soon after I recorded my interview with her. Phaedra sent me a link to a game from American Public Media called Budget Hero, and it does more or less what we were just saying couldn't be done, which is make a serious game that starts to tackle balancing the budget. Now, Phaedra points out that this game's a nice start, but it's nowhere near what her ideal vision of a budget balancing game would be. It's still missing some randomness, and it doesn't really show you the fallout of your budget decisions on unemployment, on poverty, ability to respond to future conflicts, all sorts of variables where you'd expect repercussions. So it's a game about balancing the budget, but it's still not the sort of game that we expect to see in the future that really ties up all this complexity into a fun and effective package. But still, kudos to American Public Media for proving us wrong. Let's get back to our interview with Phaedra Boinodiris on Serious Games. There's also something that video games as a whole, even the ones that everyone plays, be they, Call of Duty or whatever else, that they're still working on. And I've noticed that recently there's been some attention to this in the media, that unlike movies and novels, video games are still working on telling a story that can really inspire people and make them laugh or cry or make them think about themselves. And that's hard to do when someone's interacting with the game instead of passively receiving a story. But I'm curious how you think stories could be tied into serious games and I don't know, where you see that going forward.
Stories are a really important component to teach, I think. And it's also a great motivational tool to keep people on the hook. Mm-hmm. So, for example, with serious games, being able to teach using a story what happens down certain paths. So, for example, branching storyline games,
right,
where you make a certain decision and a story is being used to help explain what happens next. Whether it's a real city sim environment or whether it's, a healthcare game where it's a physician who's just made the wrong diagnosis. Whatever the case might be, those kinds of stories are intrinsic to learning.
Hmm. And yeah, there is some of that right now, right? But it's more moralistic, like games like Fable, where you can get horns or you can get a halo depending on what choices you make.
Right.
But I guess there's room to turn that more into something instructive where you just see the array of consequences that come from certain decisions. Makes sense.
Oh, most definitely. I mean, we were talking about the importance of games that help people make better decisions. Fable mm-hmm. is a great example. So you can start to see, okay, you keep trending down that particular path, making these types of decisions. Here's what the repercussions are going to be. Here's how it's going to affect your entire storyline and your relationships.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a very clever way of being able to teach.
Right, right. Well, I'm thinking about all this, I'm getting very excited, but there's still a part of me that's a little stubbornly resistant, because I'm part of maybe a small group of people who's doesn't really want to be a gamer yet, or avoids games because they feel like there's something more serious to be doing. So, and you started mentioning the demographics of gamers. You know, the average gamer is 37. That surprised a lot of people. There are probably also more women gamers than people realize. But I'm curious about the appeal of serious games to non-gamers and ex-gamers and people who aren't even playing that much Tetris. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I do. The way that I look at it is, again, that what's in the entertainment world, you look at, you know, Gears of War, you look at Fable 2, you look at StarCraft 2, you look at SimCity 4. Mm-hmm. A lot of these games already have nuggets of serious learning, right? Especially
right,
the Civilization right. series, for example.
Right, there have been
a lot
papers
of them,
written about that. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, you look at them. I mean, they've got huge logistics components in there, or load balancing, or mm-hmm. You know, decision making, or how is it that you collaboratively go after a mission? I mean, and the way that I look at it is, you know, if these games are already, they already have these learning nuggets to them, and but mm-hmm. they've also beautifully have created a toolkit of methodologies to really enthrall people, you know, to have them wanting to play hour after hour after hour out of their lives.
Right.
What if we were to take that same methodology, that same medium, and stretch it to include serious content? What is it that we might be able to tackle? I mean, I think there's something very alluring about that. For me, in any case, you know, the idea of being able to take it and make it fun, right? Have this environment where you motivate people to do something, you use collaborative techniques, you use games to do more than just entertain. And I just think there's great potential there.
No, I agree. Well, thank you for coming on to Psych Talk, Phaedra. I think we're going to wrap things up. But it's been great having you. It's so generous to call in from your vacation in Greece.
It is my pleasure. Thanks so much for having me, Jose. And then I look forward to our next talk.
You're listening to Psych Talk on WCOMLP, Chapel Hill and Carrboro. We just finished the first part of our show. We spoke with Phaedra Boinodiris. She creates serious games at IBM, and she was talking to us about serious games, how they can help people learn, what their future is. Clearly, it's very promising. All right, so the next section on today's show is the Trivia Challenge. Every week, a caller will join us to try to survive the onslaught of my unforgiving questions. Stay tuned.
Today's Trivia Challenge is brought to you by Flyleaf Books in Chapel Hill. Flyleaf Books is a full-service, community-oriented, independent bookstore. Flyleaf sells new books, crafts from local artisans, and more. Find out more about the store online at flyleafbooks.com.
So welcome to Psych Talk. What's your name?
Hi, my name is Jing Su.
Jing Su, where are you from?
I'm originally from Charlotte, North Carolina.
Charlotte, okay. Where are you going to school?
I'm currently attending UNC. I'm going to be a sophomore next year.
Okay, well, you're not the only one who come on the show from UNC. I'm trying to interview people locally as listener contestants, and that means that people from local colleges are going to be key sources of players. So we got another.
As long as I beat Duke.
Exactly. So this is the second UNC player. We'll have to get in some Duke and start the rivalry.
Today I'm talking about serious games, video games that are helping people learn. I do want to ask you about you as a gamer. You're actually in Chapel Hill for a gaming competition that happened recently, right?
Well, it wasn't Chapel Hill, it was in Asheville.
It was in Asheville. Oh, wow. So that you just bounced over here afterward.
Yeah.
Okay, well, it was a gaming competition, and I won't go into that because I know you didn't do as well as you would have liked.
I did well in certain events.
Okay, well, you ended up with a negative score. I'd just like to remind you.
Right.
But so did most of the players. Tell me about a game you play a lot and whether you think you learned from it.
Okay, my favorite game at the moment, and which I played like really, really way too much for the last 2 years, is a game called Defense of the Ancients.
Mm-hmm.
It's shortened to Dota.
Huh.
And so what basically happens is that you have five players on opposite side of the map, and you're basically, there's three lanes, and you're basically trying to push your way all the way onto your other side of the base and kill their ancients.
Kill their ancients. This is Dota?
Yes.
Wow, see, I've heard of Dota, I never knew it had a longer name. What's that longer name again?
Defense of the Ancients.
Defense of the
Ancients.
Because
you're trying to prevent the other team from pushing and killing your ancients.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I guess that's an important goal. I wouldn't want my ancients to get attacked. Okay, so what skills you get from this, or what learning, what's good about it?
I think like the number one thing you learn from this game more than anything else is coordination. Because when you're going, it's a 5v5 game.
Mm-hmm.
And so what happens is it's really, really hard to kill one person by yourself, all by your lonesome, like a solo kill. That's really hard to do. Unless you're like just really, really good.
Yeah.
And so what happens is most of the time you need at least two people to come out of the shadows, out of the fog of war,
mm-hmm.
and to basically gank someone.
And these are real people playing from their own computers,
online multiplayer.
Okay. So it's about collaboration, teamwork.
It's sort of like soccer or basketball where you gotta like have collaboration between your teammates in order to accomplish a certain objective. One person decides halfway through, no, I'm going to go and do my own thing. Chances are both of you aren't going to be successful.
Okay, sounds good. Sounds like the sort of thing you could use in an office or,
like
you said, on a soccer team.
And another big thing, actually, now that you mentioned the office thing, is like most of the time when you play like these public games, you meet up with these four other complete strangers who like don't know who you are, don't know if you're good or not. Like there's multiple ways to accomplish the goal of pushing towards your opponent's base and killing. Like, there's three paths. So, like, at any given time, one of your teammates would be like, no, I don't want to go with the other three guys or the four guys. I want to go and go to this other path and do my own thing.
So lots of room for argument or disagreement.
Yeah. So with, like, so much room for argument, like, you have to be able to convince everyone to get on the same page and do what's best for the team, not just for themselves. And I think that's the skill that's definitely important for, like, small group work.
Wow, okay, well, anyone listening, hire this kid. He's Dota equipped. All right, we're going to move to the trivia challenge. I filled him in on what that is. And as he knows, there's a $5 gift card to Flyleaf Books on the line.
Oh, yeah.
He already has some good ideas for what to use that for. So here are the questions. If you get 3 out of 4 right, you'll win. And if you don't get 3 out of 4 right, I'll just say bye and you'll never get that gift card. Sorry. And I don't want someone to win every week, so.
Of course not. I'll try to do my best to make
it seem like
I deserve it.
You can represent all Dota players across the world. All right. So question one. There are a lot of examples of what you could consider a serious game. I'm going to give you right now a list of potential serious games. And of those 5 in the list, 4 are actual serious games. And 1 is not a serious game. Basically, I'm asking you, which one of these is not a real game that's been created yet?
Okay.
And of course, with games, something's always going to be created. It's hard to really think of something that will never be created.
Uh-huh.
But what doesn't exist right now? So, A, EVE Online, where players try to control the largest, most powerful company in the universe. B, America's Army, an online multiplayer shooter game developed by the Army and used as a recruitment tool. C, Calculation Nation, a math game for K-12 students with individual and multiplayer challenges involving prime numbers, square numbers, factoring, and more. D, Mr. President, a political game in which players push levers in domestic and foreign policy to improve the country's health and get reelected. And E, Tragedy of the Tuna, a game where students represent a tuna fishing fleet and balance decisions that impact their own group as well as a commonly shared resource. So we've got A, EVE Online, B, America's Army, C, Calculation Nation, D, Mr. President, and E, Tragedy of the Tuna. One of these is not a game, the rest are.
Well, I know for a fact the first two are, because I read a great deal about them, like in random news gaming publications. Huh. So that's at least striking two out of the three.
Yeah, there you go.
The Calculation Nation, it's too rhymy of a name to be false. So
really? Well, I'm good at rhyming, so.
Oh, okay. All right.
Watch out.
I don't know. That sounds like something that's, really easy to develop. So, even if that wasn't a really – I'm pretty sure I can find something that resembles something.
You could,
and I will challenge you if you call that one wrong.
You could create it, while we're having this conversation.
Yeah, of course. And then I'll just, be on Google and be like, I told you so.
Fair enough.
Okay. I would have to, I'm pretty sure, the Tuna Nation thing sounds, too laughable to be fake. it sounds I don't know. It sounds it's the throwaway thing where you're trying to be this sounds way too stupid. There's no way he's going to get
it. It's actually called Tragedy of the Tuna. There's alliteration there.
I think that sounds too laughable to be fake.
Okay.
So I'm going to go with the presidential game.
You're right.
Oh, yes.
All right.
Power deduction right there.
Yeah, that was good.
Unfortunately, I didn't get that from games. Had to do way too many SAT problems.
Oh, yeah. Sadly, there are other ways to learn, right? You've got 1 point, and there are three more coming up. Just get two more right,
okay,
and you're
right,
a winner.
I'm on my way.
Yeah, good job. All right, so serious games aren't the only types of games that bring us closer to the real world. I'm going to give you a list of games. It's a little different. They're not serious games. They're not all of them, but they're tied to reality in an interesting way. These all involve real-world biology. And your job is to tell me which one hasn't been created yet, similar to last time.
Okay.
All right, so A is Pac-Mesium, in which you try to guide real paramecia toward virtual balls on a screen using mild electric fields or infusions of chemicals. B is Body Siege, in which you help your immune system by marking bacteria in your bloodstream using nanobots. C, Fold It, a competitive protein folding game that awards points for finding more realistic 3D folding patterns in real proteins. Or D, Phylo, a game for aligning similar portions of genetic sequences in which you can choose which disease you would like to help cure. So these are three of them are real. One of them is not. They all have some kind of biological application. Which one is fake?
Well, I read a lot about the protein folding stuff. I mean, the Pac-Man thing seems like something that would really be innovative. So I think that one's probably true, too.
Okay.
Can you go to the other two options?
Yeah, so the ones you haven't eliminated. So there's one called Phylo, where you align similar portions of genetic sequences, and then you can choose which disease you'd like to work on. And then there's Body Siege, in which you have nanobots in your bloodstream marking bacteria to help your immune system.
I feel like the nanobots one would make a pretty appealing action game, so I think that would be pretty legitimate. So I guess I would go with the last one.
Phylo is fake, you're saying?
Yeah.
And you're wrong.
Oh, darn.
And I'm so happy because that'll just add to the suspense. So you're one and one. Actually, Body Siege I just made up 5 minutes ago, but it is an awesome idea. I would love to have little camera-guided nanobots in my bloodstream, fighting, and I'd be, helping my immune system fight a little war. That would be awesome. I think the problem is the technology is not quite there yet.
No, I think, there is a game where you basically guide a little action man, and it goes through, a virtual world that's your body, your bloodstream, and you basically, go from place to place, and you kill things in your bloodstream. So.
You're right that there is something like that, but I thought that it was a fake, a representation.
Oh, dude, I totally didn't think you were saying, there was an actual thing. There's no way, in the world that is possible.
Okay, so I just wasn't clear.
No, it's totally fine. All right, more suspense. Let's go.
One and one, exactly. All right, question three. What's the average age of a game player according to the Entertainment Software Association? This is just to get an idea of the demographics of players, sort of who can be tapped into to play serious games, right? So I'm not going to give you multiple choices. Just make a guess of the average age of a game player. And if you're within 3 years, right, then I'll count you as correct. And keep in mind, this is games on iPhones, on computers, on consoles, Tetris to Call of Duty, all sorts of games, people who play these games. So it's their average age.
I would say 24.
24. And if you're within three, you'll get it right. The answer is 37.
Wow, okay.
Yeah, so this is really interesting. People tend to think that game players are like these pimply teenage boys. And in the last decade, a lot more women and a lot more older players have started playing. And also keep in mind, people who were 12 when video games first came around now are in their late 30s. That's another way to think of it. But actually, the full statistics from the ESA are 18% of players are under 18 years. Then there's 53% are in this middle range from 18 to 49 years. And then 29% of people who play games are 50 or older. So that's still a lot of
players. Okay, all right.
That's why the average is 37.
So I guess when I play some guys on the internet, I can't call them little kids anymore.
You can still call them that. Okay, I hear the dejection in your voice because you've lost the shot at that gift card.
No, I wanted that gift card.
However, you can still redeem yourself just as being a knowledgeable person.
Okay, all right.
And represent Dota citizens around the world again with this last question. So there's a little bit of a preface here. A 2002 study involving 12 surgeons and 21 surgical residents assessed their skill in laparoscopic surgery, which is also known as minimally invasive surgery or keyhole surgery. So there's a little, they cut a little hole in your abdomen and they can do surgery that way instead of cutting a big hole. Now, their skill in this type of surgery of these 33 surgery practitioners was assessed with a simulated surgery skills course that took about 2 days. What did the study find after administering that course? Was it A, that video game experience did not have any association with skill in the surgeries? Was it B, video game experience was associated with better surgery performance? Or C, video game experience made them have worse surgery performance?
I think at the very least, it would de-stress surgeons before like a big operation to help them chill out. Be like, oh yeah, I can just go mess around with this guy and I don't care if he dies or not. And just like let him chill out a little bit before they go into the big operation.
Not caring about whether people die, yeah.
Okay, that sounds a little bit harsh, but like, basically it's just a de-stressing mechanism.
I know what you mean. You want to know if you got it right?
Sure.
you don't sound so sure. Well, you are right.
Oh, damn. Okay, all right.
In a sense, you're right that it was the players who had more experience were also better in the surgery. And actually, to be more specific, here's a direct quote from the paper that talked about this. Surgeons who had played video games in the past for more than 3 hours per week made 37% fewer errors, were 27% faster, and scored 42% better overall on the simulated surgery skill than surgeons who had never played video games. So they did significantly better. And keep in mind, I'm not sure about the de-stressing. One thing I do know that contributed is that with laparoscopic surgery, you're figuring out where to put your tools using these little cameras that are inserted into someone's body. So there's this visual hand coordination that apparently seems to be associated with video game play.
I would definitely think there is definitely a big correlation between video game playing and hand-eye coordination. It's just how it is. You're not looking at your hands at all. You're just looking at something, and whatever you do with your hands, you expect an immediate reaction on the screen.
Well, Jin, you were 2 for 2, pretty respectable, not quite a winner. That's all right. I still respect you for coming on the show. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you.
All right, take care. Bye.
That was Jing Su playing our trivia challenge. Thank you very much, Jing. Thanks for listening. You can check out psychtalkradio.com to find podcasts, contribute ideas, and learn more about each Psych Talk show. I'd love for you to leave feedback by voice and maybe even volunteer to play the trivia challenge. I know I can be a little mean sometimes, but be brave. And you can do all that voice feedback or volunteering, by calling 919-438-1927. I look forward to hearing your feedback, good or bad, and I'm always open to suggestions for guest speakers. Thanks for listening to Carborough Community Radio. You can tune in locally at 103.5 FM, or you can catch us anywhere in the world by online streaming. To learn more about our programs, check out wcomfm.org.